This week on the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast, we welcome Ginny Carroll, CEO of the Circle of Sisterhood, for a conversation around the importance of relationships.
In the Greek community, so much happens because of collaboration and doing with others. And so building relationships is critical to success in anything, for people and organizations.
And living life without fear.
As a community, I think as a industry trying to help Greeks survive, we have got to live without fear.
Hello, and welcome to the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast. I'm your host, Matt Deeg, and this week we've got a fascinating conversation ahead of us with Ginny Carroll. We had a long chat this week, so I'm going to jump right to it after introducing her. Ginny Carroll is the founder of the Circle of Sisterhood and served on the Board of Trustees from 2010 to 2013. In January of 2014, she became the part-time executive director responsible for ensuring ongoing programmatic excellence. Ginny spent over 25 years in management and consulting and is also the principal of her own consulting business, Ingenuity. Prior to establishing her consulting business in 2001, Ginny spent 15 years in association management, five of those as the executive director of Alpha Z Delta Women's Fraternity. She is a strong proponent of the Greek experience, evidenced by several awards she has received nationally for fostering positive change to advance the fraternal movement. Ginny is a sorority woman who truly believes in the value of sorority and its experience, and the power of the sorority community to make the world a better place for girls and women. If you're interested in learning more about her work or supporting the Circle of Sisterhood after this show, you should visit Ingenuity, that's INGINUITY.com, or circleofsisterhood.org. Now, our conversation. Hey, Ginny, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time with me out of your busy schedule. I know you're traveling around a lot this summer and as school picks up, so really appreciate you sharing kind of things about your story and what you see in sorority and fraternity life. I think we'll kick it off with just a lot of people, myself included, really know you as Ginny Carroll, founder, CEO, Circle of Sisterhood. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, I think it'd be awesome to share kind of your story. There are some folks out there who know you and who told me how amazing you are. But I want the listeners to hear from you, like how you got to where you are as a consultant, as a speaker, as someone who believes in the power of sorority to change the world.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me, Matt, first. My story probably doesn't sound much different than a lot of people that get really engaged in this community. As an undergraduate sorority woman, I was an officer. I was actually chapter president for 2 years, and I wouldn't recommend that to anyone. but, you know, I was a chapter officer. I attended a leadership conference. I attended a convention. And so the hope started to dig in a little deeper about this being more than just my chapter. And so I aspired to be a consultant and travel the country for Alpha Z Delta, and I got that role. And actually, I was a consultant before Rollers on Bags, so I want empathy there.
Okay.
I worked at our headquarters following that for 15 years. So my degree, undergraduate degree, had an emphasis in graphic communication, and I became the first editor on our staff. And so that was a natural fit for me right after the consulting role. And I stayed for 15 years in lots of different roles, whether it was communications, extension, chapter services, and ultimately became the executive director, which I was for 5 years. And then I thought, God, I grew up at Alpha Z Delta. I need to do something different. So I actually left there to work for a software company that was, long story short, a six-month life lesson in bad choices.
Okay.
You know, they couldn't pay me. That was a real challenge for me. Kind of misled me in their hiring process, so, and also wanted me to be dishonest in sales, and I couldn't do that because my parents and my sorority taught me better. So I started Ingenuity in 2000, so it's actually 16 years ago that I started Ingenuity, and still today, many of my clients are fraternal organizations. I do work across sector, but I spend most of my time in the nonprofit sector because that's what I know the best, and so but a good number of my clients are fraternal organizations. So my life's work really has been attached to the fraternal experience in some way. And then in 2010, the Sister Circle of Sisterhood came to be. And so that's a whole new avenue. So to the question, how did I get to where I am today? When I thought about that, and again, I'll mention, Matt, that your questions aren't easy and make one be very thoughtful. I think the bottom line is building and leveraging networks. That is so critical to who we are and anything we choose to do. But in the Greek community, so much happens because of collaboration and doing with others. And so building relationships is critical to success in anything, for people and organizations. And so as far as I'm concerned, you have to be visible and you have to be willing to connect to people to be successful in anything you choose to do. And I have such great experiences in the Greek community and built such a tremendous network of people that I don't think without that, Ingenuity or Circle of Sisterhood would have come to be. I love a quote by Ivan Meisner who says, it's not called net setting or net eating, it's called networking, because you got to work at it. And so you never know when someone you meet or someone you touch in some way along the way is going to come back around in your life and be able to enhance it or help you in some way. So as far as I'm concerned, every relationship is important.
Yeah. No, that's really powerful. It makes me think of, have you read Adam Grant's book, Give and Take?
No.
Okay.
I'm writing that down right now.
You would love it. So he's a professor in the Wharton School out at Pennsylvania. And his book, Give and Take, talks about essentially people who give freely of themselves and of their time and of their talents and how they build relationships with other people that then do tend to come back to help them in the long run.
Absolutely.
And people want to continue to work with them. And then he contrasts those with, you know, what we call the takers, who are like, what's in it for me? What can I get out of all of these people? And in the short run, it always looks like they're doing so much better, but then long term, it always ends up biting them in the butt.
I have to read the book because that is so true. I mean, that is so true.
So, and
those are called the political animals, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, yes, very true.
Something
in your story that I wanted to circle back to, knowing kind of when this is going to get released, is going to be the start of a lot of our leadership consultants' journeys. And you mentioned, mm-hmm. you know, traveling for your national organization as a leadership consultant, and also, you know, in the days pre-wheelie bags, which, woof. I remember those days. But
how can you remember those days? You're too young for that.
Oh, my parents didn't evolve to the wheelie bag era for a long time. But what advice or things would you share for our folks who are jumping on the road with their national organizations wanting to make them a better place?
Yes. I just did a session at the FEA Field Step Conference on appreciative inquiry. And that is all about focusing on the positive core. And so the gist of this methodology is that if every organization's things are right, things go well.
Right.
And I don't care if it's a chapter, I don't care if it's your national fraternity, I don't care if it's the office on campus, wherever you are, there are things that go well. And if we focus more of our time and attention on the things that go well, we will overcome the things that don't. And so what I talk to them about, because I think the most important thing for a consultant is to ask the right questions. And so if they're asking the right questions in a meaningful way and a purposeful way and trying to build, because when you ask questions, you're building collaboration. And so those undergraduates know that you're interested in them and what they think and how they feel because you're having that conversation. And so the questions are critical, but the appreciative inquiry is about asking them related to what is positive about your experiences. So no matter, and I've used this in my consulting work for years, no matter who comes to you with a problem or what that problem is, you can turn it around by asking them what it looked like when it was at its best. So in other words, it doesn't matter what the problem is, because we don't know it's a problem unless we've seen the best.
Right.
So I don't know that the sisterhood in my chapter sucks unless I know what sisterhood in my chapter has been like at its best. And so simply bridging that helps them get to the solution, and it looks like maybe the consultant got them there, but really it was the questions that did. So in other words, well, if it's so bad, what was it like when it felt good for you, when it was at its best? And that undergraduate explains that to you, and then you simply say, well, why is that important? So you're having that person articulate what it is they're looking for, why it's important or of value to the to their chapter, and then the next question is, well, how do we get there?
Right.
How do we get back to that? So really, a pre-seed inquiry is a three-part question, or a three-part interview. And they can use it anywhere they go for any conversation, any issue, even goal setting. And so that, to me, is the most important advice to a consultant, is the questions you ask are going to get you the answers they need. And that's the ideal, because you want them to have buy-in to what you're trying to get them to do. And by having that kind of a conversation, they feel like they did it. And they did, actually. So they're really coming up with the answers for you. And so that methodology, I think, is tremendous and applies in almost anything you can do. And so, you know, I did this session, and I said, you're probably not going to read the book. If you want to read the book, there's a thin book to start with. But this is basically the gist. You ask the three questions this way, and it'll help anybody get to a solution.
Well, and I love it, because I think it's not just even applicable for our consultant friends, but for anybody in the field. We do a lot of, like, where's the problem, rather than looking at when were we at our best in a community.
Yeah.
And I think the other piece that I know was in there, but that really stood out, is also thinking about, like, what was the situation around when sisterhood was at an all-time high, right? So there were some things and some contributing factors that were, like, adding and helping sisterhood to be at an all-time high. And so if we go back and we say, well, also, what was going on then that was
right.
helping?
Exactly.
They can return to it.
Yeah. And for a campus professional, I mean, I can't even imagine how many times campus professionals have students walking in their office door saying, this is the problem, how am I going to deal with it? I mean, I can't even imagine.
Every day.
And so, and I think that's the big difference between the campus professional and the fraternity and sorority professional. Campus professionals have the student walking in their office daily. The fraternity and sorority professional doesn't. They have to do it from a distance. But this particular, like, this methodology works for both. It doesn't matter. And so Cooper Ryder out of Case Western Reserve, who was the father of this methodology.
Yep, he's awesome.
He talks about, you can't just ask the question. You have to ask for the detail. So, okay, if this is the way you see it now, what was it like at its best, and what was happening? Like, if this is what sisterhood was at its best, what was happening around it? I mean, what were people doing? What were they talking about? What were they doing with each other? And so the more detail you can get in those answers, the more you're going to get to, okay, well, then how do we get back there? How do we make that happen again? Just like you said. I mean, same thing.
Yeah, and it moves us away from, and I know this is a part of the appreciative inquiry mindset, is it moves us away from that deficit mindset. And, you know, all in all, that makes people want to have more relationships with us when we're looking for those positive things, rather than, oh, here's all the stuff that your chapter's doing wrong, and now
exactly.
I'm going to help you fix them.
Well, he calls it the positive core. So you're asking students or organizations or whoever to live in the positive core.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to bring, and then as a professional, you become, they know that they're not going to come to your office until they have figured that out, because they know you're going to say, well, tell me what it's like at its best.
Yeah, and we've given them some tools to use, which is ultimately our end goal, right? Like,
right.
Equip them so we're out of a job, because we'll always have a job, but equip them so then they can do all this stuff for themselves, which...
Right.
Because we're not always going to be there.
If you ask them to live in the positive core, which is the best and why it's valued, that's the positive core. So, like, if you're working with an entire chapter and you're asking them to go to that space, the conversation changes completely. So if I've asked an entire chapter of people to tell me, what do you like when you're at your best, clearly define it for me. And you do that by saying, simply, tell me when you were the proudest, what's your proudest moment as a member? what were you doing, what was the chapter doing, what was happening around you, what made it happen? And then, why is that important? So now you've got everybody in that room, every member of that chapter, sitting in their positive core. That's a totally different place to be when you're trying to set direction for the future. Okay, now how do we do this continually? Like, how do we make sure we live in this space all the time? And then that will overcome all the challenges, I think, if they work hard at it.
Oh, yeah. No, I just, and it resonates really strongly with me because I just came back from facilitating leadership. You know, the whole idea of, right, living in possibility and looking beyond just all of those different things. And true life hero is good old Ben Zander. Like, that man is just, yeah, I would take him as an advisor or something any day.
So I've worked with leadership for 14 years a while back. And so the vision to reality thing, that is, my story there is the circle of sisterhood.
Awesome.
That is vision to reality.
That's wonderful. And,
yeah.
You know, and
if I'd only had, when I was working with leadership, if I'd only had that thought in my brain, it would have helped me so much more. But I did go back to those concepts taught at that conference about when this whole thing was coming to be.
Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned, and we'll get back to like all these cool things about like working with chapters and inspiring possibility and circle of sisterhood and all of that, but you mentioned that you were an executive director for your national organization, and that was one thing I totally didn't know until I talked with one of your friends and was like, hey, I'm interviewing Jenny Carroll. What should I ask her about? And they were like, you should talk to her about being an executive director. I was like, okay, I will. talk to me about that experience, because, you know, we don't always get to chat with someone who has served in that role dealing with the complexities at the higher level. What was that role like? Challenges, successes, things people wouldn't know about executive directors of our national organizations, what they deal with.
Right. Well, like you said, I think the role that, you know, a lot call them chief staff executives of nonprofits is incredibly complex and difficult. And since you and I don't have 6 hours, I'll kind of slim this down. But as I've evolved as a professional and in hindsight, I believe the role of that role that I played was about 5 primary things. And so when I was in the role, I really tried to focus on strategy and culture and talent and focus. And then I'll go back to relationships, because those are critical whatever you're doing. So by strategy, I mean helping to develop, understand, and communicate the organization's strategy. Because your staff and your chief executive is most often the consistency of the organization. You've got great volunteers working for the organizations that are turning over repeatedly. And so your staff really becomes your consistency and your consistent messenger. And so being able to make sure that the organizational strategy was being communicated, but then making sure it was also accomplishable and accomplished, is a huge role of the executive. And I'm a huge fan of Peter Drucker and Patrick Lencioni, okay? And so Drucker, the second piece of that is culture. And Drucker said, culture eats strategy for lunch.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that is so true. And Lencioni, I think I don't know when his book The Advantage came out, but he takes culture a step further to organizational health and talks about focusing on minimal politics, minimal confusion, high morale, high productivity, and low turnover. And so after I read his book, I thought in hindsight, wow, that is probably where I spent most of my time as the executive director. I had great people around me to focus on, staff people, to focus on marketing and finance and technology and all those things, so that I could focus on strategy and what Lencioni has put into words for me, organizational health. So making sure, trying my best to make sure that politics didn't get in our way, that confusion didn't get in our way, that there was high morale throughout the organization, and which leads to productivity, and that low turnover on my staff. Because consistently having to train people takes a lot of time.
Right.
And so that's the talent manager piece. And so a huge part of that is the talent and needing to leverage and keep the best talent at the table and do that, and because to do that, you have to minimize the politics and the confusion. And so my team, I was lucky. I had a rock solid team that was focused, and we had been together a long time. So that was helpful. For me, a challenge was moving from their peer to their boss.
Right. I mean,
that was a challenge, and is a challenge for anybody. And by focus, one of those things is focus, I mean on the few things. Like I think as fraternal organizations, we have a tendency to chase around shiny objects. What's the cool thing this week? Well, let's go after that. And so that diverts us from our strategy, because we really need to hone in on the few things that we're going to do well at this period of time in our existence, and stay there and not, I mean, so many times I have to fight the battle of, well, okay, we've tried that for a year, it didn't work, let's try this. Well, okay, but sometimes it takes more than a year for things to evolve to what they could potentially be. And then the fifth part of that was the relationship. So huge on every level. We talked about that internally and externally. I was determined, when I became the executive director of LZ Delta, I was determined to build relationships outside the organization as much as I was inside the organization. So, for example, I felt relationships with campus professionals was hugely significant for the success of the organization. And so it was critical. And so I spent a lot of time building those relationships, or furthering those relationships, because we're all in the same ship. I mean, we're all trying to do the same thing.
Right.
And I guess to your answer about challenges, I mentioned one, but having the time to focus on all those things I talked about becomes a challenge, because you've got crises you have to deal with, and you've got the minutiae and the administration of the job you have to deal with, and people may not want to hear me say this, but babysitting volunteers is part of the job as well. And so... although none of our organizations with fraternal would exist without those volunteers. So I know how important they are. Some more high maintenance than others. Most doing the work they need to be doing for the organization in incredible ways. Doesn't mean there's not cave people in every organization, which that stands for citizens against virtually everything. But yeah, the challenge for me as the executive director was having to carve out the time to be disciplined enough to focus on those things. And another huge challenge was committing to have a life outside of work, because we can make this work all-consuming, and I failed there. And so that's why I only lasted 5 years in the executive role, because I had no life outside of work. And so this industry tends to burn people out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is the people who are part of what we're doing. We're all overachievers. This is a generalization. We're all overachievers, generalization. We're all type A.
Right.
And so we'll put 160% of our lives into it to make sure it's a great job.
Right. And we're all passionate about it too, right?
You know,
absolutely. No one gets into this work going, oh, you know, that's a job. I'm going to take that. That sounds like a good thing to do.
Right.
Like, we're ready to give our all and stay up and cry and write in all of these different things because we care deeply about the things that we're involved in.
Yeah. And our experience, and what our experience did for us.
Yeah.
It's the give back piece.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think when you list off kind of those five different roles, you know, I just think about just trying to juggle all of those and the...
Uh-huh.
You know, the amount of chaos, right? Like, I'm going to build relationships, but also build the, right, like, and how interconnected everything is while trying to keep in mind, here's our strategy and here's where we're moving forward to.
Right.
And so, you know, for folks who are like, well, what the heck does an executive director do? Well, they do everything.
Yeah.
And I love what you're talking about with the whole idea of culture and the focus, and The Advantage is probably one of my favorite books around, like, organizational behavior, just because of that information around organizational health and the different contributors to it, and how even missing one aspect of that can really harm or damage an organization and its functioning. And so I've seen it happen within, like, a workplace, and when organizational health is low, you know, Things don't happen the way they ought to happen.
Well, and Lencioni is the first one that'll tell you that And I firmly believe this, that most organizations or work environments that are struggling, trust is an issue.
Right.
And I think in some ways we have a tendency to build a culture of distrust. I mean, we policy away behavior or without really truly understanding its core. And so I just think, yeah, if we... But that was one of the things I was, you know, in answer to one of your questions, what can we do better as a community? We have got to find a way to trust each other, more so than we already do in some cases. But we've also got to evaluate. Any organization or workplace has to evaluate, or individual, how am I building trust and how am I diminishing trust?
Mm-hmm.
With my students, with my coworkers, with my colleagues, everybody.
Right.
I think trust is huge.
Oh, it totally is. I was having a conversation actually just this morning and then earlier this week that, you know, when you don't trust people, it shows up in how you build policies and it shows up in how you approach the work. And right. So I don't trust you. Therefore, I'm going to make you fill out and sign all these different papers because I don't trust that you're going to just be honest with me and tell me the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But what that breeds is students then don't trust us, right?
Right.
I think you can draw a pretty easy parallel or connection between, you know, the Fraternity Sorority Life office or national organization that doesn't trust its student members and the same lack of trust being reflected back.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you don't trust me, why should I trust you? So now we're just at an impasse and no one's going to move forward until we're willing to give one another the benefit of the doubt. And the same thing with, you know, national organizations and their relationships with campus-based professionals, right? Like, we don't trust you, you don't trust us, and now we just don't talk, and it's real awkward and miserable, and no one's reaching out to each other.
Oh, what a waste.
Right. You know, that partnership, oh gosh, can go so far for us.
Mm-hmm.
So... we touched on this a little bit with just this heavy focus in on relationships. And I would agree that, you know, relationships and connecting, being able to call on people and connect with people. And if I have a question or if they have a question, just everybody being able to work with one another is so key for professionals, for undergraduate leaders, for undergraduates in general. What are some other things that you've learned working with others to be innovators and leaders that you think people should know?
I love that question. And my gut reaction to that, and so I want to stick with my gut reaction to that, is to obliterate fear. And the other piece of that is to find the sweet spot. So for any professional listening to this, I have been so lucky because I've never really had a job I don't like. And so to be able to wake up every day and love what you do is what everybody's after. I mean,
yeah.
That's what everybody wants. And I feel exceptionally lucky because I have had that my entire career. And so I think part of that, you just, my favorite quote ever is, leap and the net will appear. So, and it's hanging in my office. I mean, I'm looking at it right now. So had that not been my mantra, had I not thought that way, I would have never started Ingenuity. I would have never walked the path of Circle of Sisterhood. None of that would have ever happened because those were true leaps of faith. It's a leap of faith to start a business and especially to start a nonprofit, especially a nonprofit that works internationally, especially after 9/11 in this country. I mean, that is
right.
Hard to do. And even hard to get the charity status for. So it takes a lot of hard work. And if I was afraid of hard work or the unknown, none of those things would have happened. And so sometimes we just got to take a leap of faith and trust. Let's go back to trust, Matt. Trust those people around us to help. And I am the first one to say women are the worst. I mean, and me too. I mean, this is the pot calling the kettle black. Like, I have to do this because they can't do it as good as I do it. Right?
Right.
But in reality, when I have myself spread so thin, I'm not doing it as well as they're doing it. And so we have to have other people around us to help us in all that hard work. And so we need, as a community, I think as a industry trying to help Greeks survive, we have got to live without fear. Not only as a community, but as individuals. And we need to take chances regularly, and we need to try new things. And we need to support the people that are trying those new things because they're doing it, because they're trying new things. And not try to disparage them or talk negatively about what the chances they're trying to take to make the community better.
Yeah.
Because that happens too often.
If this were like a conference speech, I'd be standing and applauding you right now.
Because,
you know, I think we're held back either from that lack of support or just from the fear of not being supported or making a mistake or failing. And so everything that you're saying is like, yes, this is the world that I hope we can live in, where mm-hmm. we're not afraid to take these chances because we trust in ourselves and we trust in the people who are around us to support us and fill in those gaps and blanks where we might, you know, fall short. And so yes to all of that.
The bottom line, Matt, is that you and I and everybody that is so passionate about this community and what we do and what we provide to students and all of that, all of us are trying to make it better. Nobody's trying to destroy it. Nobody. And so for anybody to think that someone tackling a new project or someone introducing a new way to do things is trying to ruin this experience is that's immature. Because in reality, we are all extremely passionate about what this is that we provide and trying to make it better. And so there are people who will try new things and people who will incorporate new ways, and we need to support that and not be afraid of it and not try to damage it. I mean, I've watched that with the Circle of Sisterhood. So I think there were people waiting for it to fail.
Mm.
Like, I had somebody come up to me at one of the regional conferences probably last year, I think, or the year before. So the Circle Sister was 4 or 5 years old, 4 years old. And this person said to me, you know, I remember seeing you at AFA like 4 years ago when this was all being introduced, and I remember thinking, I wonder how long that's going to last.
Oh.
And so my response to that was, I'm going to take that as a compliment. So that's where we tend to sit as a community.
Right.
Let's just sit back and watch that and see if it fails or if it makes it. And if it makes it, then we'll support it.
Right.
And that's really frustrating to me, because the people who are out there trying to make significant change for our community and make it better for our students and make it better for our members and make it better for our campus, the people who love this thing we do, I'm all for them. Go for it. Try it. Do it. Do it. Because nobody else is.
Right.
So what is failure but a lesson? And I think that's the challenge with our youngest generation, is that they hate to fail. And so we've got to help them understand it's okay. It's okay to fail.
Right.
That's where your most valuable lessons come from.
Take that risk and that leap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So leap, fear. We have to obliterate fear. I mean, we have to just... And I see that happening more and more now. I think early in my career, it didn't happen enough. And there's so many more people in our industry that are eager to make change for the longevity of this experience. And so I love seeing that, and I love supporting that, and I will. And then the other part of your question was, the other biggest lesson is a sweet spot. So that's the place to me where you know you're meant to be. So if you're doing your sweet spot work, every cell in your body feels like you're supposed to be doing that at that moment. Like, you just know, wow, I'm good at this. I feel good about this. People are reacting well to this. This is what I love. So you, my friend, moving on for your doctorate, excuse me, are getting to that sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm assuming that's what you're doing to get to that place. So,
oh, yeah.
So for example, the Circle of Sisterhood was a cosmic explosion of the three things that I'm really passionate about in my life. Education, women's empowerment, and sorority. So all those things came together for this to be a reality. So doing the work that I'm doing is in my DNA because I'm so passionate about those three things. So if you know what you're really passionate about, what your sweet spot is, and you stay in that space, you'll find ways to be in that space. But I think if I were going to say anything to people who wanted to be innovators and leaders, one of the lessons is it takes time to get to that. I mean, you have to try different things to know where your sweet spot is. So you have to try different experiences and different education and different opportunities and different jobs even.
Right.
You have to move around and try new things to be able to find what that spot really is.
Yeah, it reminds me of, you know, when you're a kid growing up and, you know, I watch parents around me now and they throw their kids into, you know, five different sports and activities, and they're like, okay, we're just going to get you in all of these and you figure out the one that you like the most, right?
Right,
You know, they're trying to help them find the sweet spot, but also in somewhat of an overwhelming way.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they don't make them stick with something that is not their sweet spot. Like, here's the thing, I can't skate backwards. Tried it, doesn't work. And so my future as a hockey player was never going to ever happen. And so, you know, I moved on to soccer where I can run backwards. But yeah, so professionally and for any leader, finding those things that were like, this is, I love the sweet spot. It makes me think of the dude with the longest and hardest to pronounce last name in the world, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Also one of my favorite last names to say. And his concept of flow, right? Where you're like being challenged, but you can meet the challenge and it is an exhilarating experience for us to be in that zone. And I think that's our wish for all professionals and for all students, that they can find their flow and really just constantly live in that zone.
And especially for campus professionals, because they get to be with students every day, is know that every day you're helping students get to that place.
Yeah.
So whatever you're doing with them, you're helping them get to that place.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about this idea of, you know, where your inspiration comes from. And you've been doing this work with sororities and sorority women for a little while now. That's my code word for seasoned professional.
Right.
But what is it that inspires you about working with sorority women and within the sorority community? And I know that that's not just your only area of work. But, you know, Fraternity Sorority Life podcast, so got to talk about sororities.
Right. Well, and it's a good chunk of my work. And so if I'm looking at Ingenuity as my consulting work and Circle Sisterhood, it's a big chunk of my work. So to answer the question, what inspires me? Everything, every piece of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, it all does. And so there's nothing more meaningful to me than inspiring women to realize their potential. And my sorority taught me that. It's actually, I think, their tagline, the vision. So inspiring women to realize their potential. That has been my life's work. And so I'm a staunch advocate for the experience and what it can do for young people. And so, and it being the sorority experience was my launch pad to everything I've been able to accomplish. So I literally, if I'm talking to a group of students, I will tell them, joining a fraternal organization is one of the best decisions you ever made. Because I can stand here right now and tell you, as someone who feels I've had a very successful career, that all of it, that's my choosing to join a Greek organization was the launch pad. That there's no way I would have been able to wake up every day today loving what I do and feeling like I'm making a difference in the world had my evolution as a leader not started by joining a sorority, because I don't think I would have had the same opportunity. I know I wouldn't have had the same opportunity. There's just no way. So I think there are so many young sorority women and fraternity men as well on college campuses trying to do the right thing and take advantage of everything that the experience offers. I think we need, this is back to the positive core, we need to focus more on that crowd of people.
Oh yeah. And provide.
There are so many. Yeah, and I'm lucky because I get to live in and among them when I'm on college campus. I don't go to campus to talk about risk management. That's not my job.
Yeah.
So there are just so many, and you know, along with that, there's so many adults trying to do their best for the organizations and their best every day. So the adults are really trying to evolve Greek and take it to the next level as well. And I'm proud that a lot of these sororities, like I've worked with a lot, probably 24 of the 26 national family groups have allowed me the opportunity to help them in a consulting role. You know, once upon a time, Matt, nobody would hire someone not of their own organization, mm-hmm. nor would they let anybody work with them not of their own organization. And that has changed significantly in the past decade or so. And so I love that because it's all about getting the right talent in the room.
Right. And it's about using, and anybody can help to inspire someone to reach their full potential, right? It doesn't matter,
right.
you know, even if you're not affiliated, you can provide some form of inspiration, education to help someone to reach that full potential. I think that's what inspires me too about the work that we get to do and why, you know, even in PhD world and beyond, I hope to stay connected to the fraternal movement because I see students becoming their best and
right.
striving to reach that potential. And that's a world that I want to live in and contribute to is one where we continually help make better men and women through their experiences.
Mm-hmm. And they're just sponges. I mean, they're just sponges.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing more gratifying than all across the spectrum, working with people who are willing to continue to learn. Like, I get so frustrated by people who will say, I'm not going to that workshop, I know all that. Really? Your whole objective should be, I don't care. If you're at a training, you're supposed to go to a training program at work, and you feel like you've heard it six times. Well, then go into the meeting thinking, what am I going to learn this time that I don't know?
Right.
It could be about a person. It could be about a process. It could be about a decision. It could be about anything. But instead of going into every meeting thinking, God, I got to have this meeting again, or I know all this stuff. If you stop learning, you stop.
Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's not all about you, too, right? Because, you know, sometimes the best learning you're going to have is also in sharing some of the information that you've already received. So,
right.
you know, if I've heard a training six different times, I may see a totally different angle or look at it from a new perspective, but I can also, you know, instead of it being about me and, you know, what am I going to get out of this?
Right.
Going back to that whole thing about relationships, right? Like, what am I going to give? How am I going to contribute to this experience to help
exactly.
other people to make it better and more worthwhile for them and me?
Because ultimately, if I'm sitting in a room with colleagues and I have learned something different about a colleague in the room that day, our relationship's now different. And so I know them on a different level. And perhaps I am more empathetic to something they're trying to do or a decision they're trying to make. And so there's never not something you can learn in a room full of people.
Yeah, very true. So zooming out even further beyond just our work with sororities and sorority women, but just to the fraternity sorority landscape.
Yeah.
You know, I know you are living... You enjoy living in the land of possibility, and so I might disrupt that a little bit with this question, but what things encourage you about our landscape, but then also what are those areas where you're like, we should do more appreciative inquiry around these things?
Right.
I put it in a positive light.
That was good. So there's some days where I sit and I think, we've been trying to tackle the same thing for
mm-hmm.
decades. And we really have. But the bottom line, and Dave Westall, good friend of mine, and also was executive director of his fraternity, used to have, if you went into his office and sat at his desk and pulled out his drawer, you'd see a little post note that says, remember they're 18. Because we're the ones that age, not our students. And so the students will always be 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. So they will always be sowing their wild oats or whatever phrase you want to use. They'll
right.
always be pushing the limits. They'll always be trying new things. They'll always be drinking alcohol. They'll always be trying drugs. They'll be doing all those things that we want to policy away. So that's not going to change. And so I think we need to be better understanding of the community that those issues are always going to be issues we deal with people of this age. And in the first place, they have true freedom.
Right.
And so, you know, if we could take back all the time as an industry we've spent on risk management, what would we do with that time? And I'm not I think that would be a fun and cool conversation for people to have, because it's so much time that we've spent there.
Right.
But first, I am very clear about the fact that I get the tremendous opportunity to live in a space where students are at their absolute best. That when I'm with students, we're sitting out around the room as the most educated women in the world, talking about how to provide access to education for girls around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So our conversations are different, and don't focus on the negative stuff. So I get to travel this country. I have the worst job in the world. I get to travel the country and share with the story of the power of the sorority community to be part of a solution to a global crisis. That's what I get to do. I get to travel and tell sorority communities about how they're involved in answering the call for a global crisis. And it's not, you know, and more men are stepping in as well, which I think is significant. Here's my thing about this community we love. When you challenge this community, we step up.
Oh, yeah.
Every time. So here are my hopes for the community, that we can focus more attention on what we do well and do more of that than spend so much time focused on what we do poorly. That's the whole appreciative inquiry thing. I hope that fraternal organizations get out of their own way and stop getting mired in the tradition and the policy and the bylaws. Scrap the crap that keeps you back and move on.
Mm-hmm.
And do it efficiently and nimbly. Because we've set ourselves up not to be able to move nimbly as organizations. And that's a real challenge today. Because if the objective of a national men's group or women's group is to have the undergraduates of today sitting in their chairs as leadership of their organizations in 10, 15 years, they better change. Because these students move at light speed. And they do not, patience is not a virtue, and they do not understand that it takes a biennium to get things changed.
Right.
So, yeah, scrap.
We get mired in all of the, you know, all the bureaucracy and following different things instead of saying, okay, what are we trying to accomplish? How can we get there? Okay, go do that.
Right.
And yep. I think you get that really, you get that cool opportunity with Circle of Sisterhood to say, okay, here's this thing. We're going to try to tackle it. What are we going to do to fix it? And there's no, like, well, let's put a policy and let's make people wait 15 days before they get... Right, like, we're not even worrying about that. You're just like, here's what we're going to do. Let's go and attack this problem.
Right. And they, and speaking from the perspective of Circle of Sisterhood, they did.
Yeah.
I mean, we're now sitting with 200 campuses supporting us.
Yeah.
And so we literally put the message out there that the sorority community is the most educated women in the world, need to be part of the solution. And these college women, okay, let's go.
Right. And we gave them something to channel their energy towards, and something hugely positive. And I think perfect segue into, I can't have a conversation with Ginny Carroll, CEO of Circle of Sisterhood, an organization that I absolutely love.
Yeah.
You know, the opportunity to provide educational access, and I'm going to let you talk about this because I know you can do it better than I can. But to provide educational access and to break down barriers for women in developing countries so that they can have access to education and build themselves and their communities and their children and everybody around them up is just so incredible. And I think it is the perfect avenue for our sorority women to be involved in trying to impact the world. And so... Mm-hmm. Talk to me about kind of where this idea came from, and we'll touch a little bit more on, like, how's it going and how people can get involved a little bit later, but, like, give me the Circle of Sisterhood, like, here's where we are, and here's how we got right here.
Well, you're funny, because you just did a great job explaining it. I mean, that was great. I love to hear that. Where did it start? It started with a book. So, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Around the World. Mm-hmm. And I fun interview on Oprah when she had her own show and every afternoon. I loved her show. And I would often DVR what I was interested in because I couldn't watch everyone. And so she was talking about girls' education. And it was the authors of that book. And their interview literally revealed, oh my God, the brutal truth about what women deal with around the world.
Right.
And so I'm listening to them going, how do I not know this? So I bought the book and read it within a week. And it changed everything about what I thought about the world. Because I had no idea in my insular, privileged, white woman world that women were being treated so horribly around the world. And so it was stunning to me. I couldn't get over it. I couldn't stop talking about it. I asked everyone I knew to read the book. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many of those books I bought and just gave them to people. You know, because when you're a woman and you start learning about 2/3 of the illiterate adults in the world are women.
Right.
And you start learning, and you're an educated woman. Like, we are the most educated, sorority women are the most educated women in the world. I think, and I'm sure Junior League or somebody else would probably fight me on this, but I think we are the largest identifiable body of college-educated women in the world. And so, you know, after I started learning all this stuff, you know, 70% of school youth in the world are girls, and in lots of places in the world, they don't want girls to be educated at all.
Right.
And so, and I know, significantly because of based on research I've done recently, but that education is the answer to a lot of the global issues women face.
Mm-hmm.
So, we know that education will eradicate poverty, but will help in other areas, like human trafficking or discrimination or sexual brutality or gendercide or anything like that. So it'll help. And so I'm sitting here thinking, why wouldn't this community be involved in this? It was just like one of those light bulb moments where you're like, why? We have to be a part of the solution. And it would be so much more powerful if we could do this as one community and not be somebody's philanthropy, right? And so I read the book. Asked all my friends to read it. A lot of them did. And like with most movements, it started with that simple question. I mean, mine was, why wouldn't the sorority community be part of the answer to the global crisis in girls' education? We're the most educated women in the world.
Right.
So that I kept asking my friends as I asked them to read the book. So the next step was literally, Matt, a group of 10 women sat around a table. And we, you know, let's come talk to me about the book. And so we started that conversation. And out of that conversation came, what are we going to do? And out of that came, we need to rally the sorority community. Well, you're going to find this funny, but the first name of the organization was Educated Women Educating Women, and because we were going to try to tackle all college-educated women and get them involved in this. And it very quickly morphed into, no, we got to hone in on the sorority community because we could try to get other people involved, but the sorority community is going to engage and move quickly.
Right.
And we should be doing this. And so so we didn't pick Educated Women, Educated Women, because the acronym was boo-oo, and that wasn't going to fly. And, I mean, that was the hardest part of the whole thing, was finding the name. But anyway, so that group of women really started to help drive this this thing. And so, you know, we tried to get charity status, which is a difficult thing to do when you're going to work internationally, and we did within a year, which was pretty significant because somebody introduced me to a powerful bulldog female attorney who worked with the IRS and hounded them until we have had our status.
Wow.
So and a sorority woman. So 2010, September 2010, so we're approaching our 6th birthday, and we've had an impact in 22 countries. And this summer, like right now, construction of the 10th school is going up. It's happening. So is what I'm talking about, this generation moves at light speed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, this is certainly not an undergraduate thing. I was at a conference this summer, and somebody said, well, I know this is an undergraduate thing. Oh, no, it's not. It's clearly not. Like, the first conversations were, if every woman who has ever put Greek letters on her chest gave $100 once in her lifetime, we could change girls' education forever.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Wow.
Right? So that was the original vision. if we could get every sorority woman just to give $100 one time in her lifetime, literally. Now, that's a lot easier said than done, because it's hard to get to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so that has, the alumni side has been slower in trying to get reach out to them, but, you know, we challenge our supporters to leverage their networks. So, networks, there we go, back to that word again. And literally, you know, the undergraduates and the access to them through, and NPC has been very accommodating. I mean, they have early on established an agreement with us to help support us in this effort. So, and then, you know, the regional conferences have been tremendous in getting the message. But they've picked it up and run with it, and these school bills are now being funded by communities.
Right.
So,
I saw, like, UNC was out there this summer, right? And or NC State.
NC State,
Clemson.
University of Pittsburgh. Clemson is on their second one. So in March, Clemson is going to DePaul to break ground on a school, a team of Clemson sorority women. So it's just stunning to me that what is happening. People ask me that all the time. Are you surprised? I'm like, I am, and I'm not. I am because of how quickly it's occurred and how much impact we are having, and I'm not because I know this community.
Right.
And this community rallies when
yeah.
you ask them to. And so, you know, Cheryl Wudun, who that book I talked about, was one of the co-author of that book. I've met her in person 3 times, and she has asked me each time, how are the men involved? How are you involving the men? And the first couple times I met her, I was like, can I get the women involved first? Because really, you have to build up, you know, momentum in the community. And what I have found fascinating in this whole thing is that the women have gotten the men involved.
Right.
Because, and I say this to sorority women all the time, I don't care whether you think they're paying attention or not. They are. And so whatever conversations you're having or whatever you're doing, they're paying attention. And so, 'cause bottom line to me is the oppression of women around the world will not end until the men are involved.
Right.
And so as more men support this effort, it's just more meaningful because they have to be part of the solution. And so this whole brothers for sisters phase, I think is going to be significant because they want to.
Right.
You know, at University of Iowa, interestingly, the University of Iowa, the Multicultural Greek Council is the one that stepped up first and supported us and has been supporting us since day one through a penny drive on their campus every year. And just last year, they invited all the other groups on campus to engage too. Now the whole entire Greek community at the University of Iowa is engaged in supporting the Circle of Sisters. All councils, all of them, NPHC, IFC, MGC, and NPC are all engaged. That is the ideal.
Yeah.
Right? That we all as Greeks understand, as the most educated people in the world, what we can do. So I think that's starting to happen more, which to me is that's really significant. I mean, I know this is most 18, 19, 20-year-old men probably see this. It's not my issue. It's a women's issue. But if you look at our mission statement, it's about uplifting women from poverty and oppression through education.
Mm-hmm.
And that won't happen until the men are involved in that as well.
Yeah.
Okay, I could talk about this for 3 years. Matt, you probably don't want me to.
I know, but I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, again, as someone, I don't even remember how I was introduced to Circle of Sisterhood, and I've read Half the Sky, and I think I've watched like part of the documentary, and I have not watched A Path Appears yet. You know, the follow up.
That's another good one.
The follow up to the whole thing. I think both available on Netflix, maybe.
Right. Girl Rising is another one you should watch.
Yeah.
That's specific to girls' education, which is very powerful.
But it makes me think about, right, the need for, because as a male, I'm just here thinking about, one, recognizing the immense amount of privilege that I have as a, you know, a white, heterosexual, Protestant male about to start a PhD program, right? Like, I check
right.
all the boxes. And it's one of those like, well, what are you actually doing with that? And I think depending on, you know, depending on the topic that people want, but for me, education is the most important thing in the world. And so, you know, I really, my hope is similar to yours, that more men will see this and say, you know, it's not against men. It's helping to help women rise.
Right.
So, because when we raise up women in the U.S. and in the developing world, wherever we are, we raise up the entirety of society, right? Because that's where that whole half the sky thing comes from, right? Women hold up half the sky.
Right.
And, you know, if we're not providing them with opportunities to continue to hold up half the sky, then we're really doing the entirety of humanity a disservice. And so, you know, it makes me think, right, it's not a female issue, it's a human issue, but they're the ones that are most affected. And so how can we continue to provide that? And again, I completely love the idea of getting our educated sorority women and educated fraternity men involved in this opportunity to build schools, or, you know, some of the things I remember from like Half the Sky is helping provide so that, you know, girls have access to bathrooms and to all the different supplies and things that they need to actually go to school in their areas that, you know, we just totally take for granted. And it's one of those moments of like, wait a second, I have all of these things and I've never even questioned them.
Right. And so, you know, our mission is to remove the barrier.
Right.
So it doesn't mean we're just about building schools or putting women, girls, butts in seats in classrooms. That's not it. I mean,
right.
There's so many things. We provide malaria nets. The schools all have to have, all the agreement is that our schools have two latrines, one for the boys and one for the girls.
Right.
It's, you know, tuition is boarding school. We're helping organizations who are reintegrating girls and boys both from sex trade, from sex trafficking, because you can't just pull them out and not provide a means with which they can earn a living, because they're just going to go back because it's all they've ever known.
Right.
We just put electricity in a school in Peru. These children, a girls' school in Peru, so these girls are seeing or have access to the internet for the first time in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So they're learning the window of opportunity and education has just opened significantly for them. So it's not, there's so many ways to remove the barrier. I mean, you talk about latrines, puberty is a barrier.
Yeah.
So in a lot of parts of the world, that's taboo. We don't want you around us, right? And or if you're going to school under a tree, you have no way to take care of yourself.
Right.
So every school that the Circle of Sisterhood funds, the agreement, the covenant with the community or the village is that 50% of the students, like girls, will be in the school in equal numbers as boys, and every school has two latrines. So we're trying to remove the barrier in any way we can for all of those. And I think the biggest, sometimes, the pushback we get as an organization is, we have so much to do in this country, why are we helping around the world? Or we get questions, can my, you know, because the power of this is that it's the entire sorority community doing it together. So not only does the world see the power of this community of women, but what's happening, the byproducts on the college campuses are just so significant to me, because these communities are having different conversations. I had a campus professional say to me, my women are talking about women's empowerment. They've never talked about women's empowerment.
Right.
Or you see tweets or social media or Instagram posts about, I was, you know, thinking, God, I don't want to go to class today. And then I remembered that why we support the Circle of Sisterhood. Mm. And I need to be in class today because I get to go. Because, you know, the bottom line, why are we helping? We also help in this domestically. I'm just going to throw that out there. We do domestic granting. But because in other parts of the world, when women are educated, they reinvest 90% of what they earn into their families and communities, which better their communities. And it's proven that the more women they're educated in a community or a village or a country, that country is less volatile.
Right.
And what are we dealing with as a country but volatile communities? And so there's so many reasons it's as important for us to help in this way. And I see this as the sorority community's global humanitarian effort together to make change. And I'll tell you this, I went to the White House United State of Women Summit in June, and I loved knocking the stereotype right out of the room, because people would say to me, who do you work for? And I would say the Circle of Sisterhood. And we leverage the influence of the sorority community to remove barriers to education for girls around the world. And their faces would go, really? Like,
right.
Because they're thinking stereotype, right?
Yeah.
And I said, and then my follow-up to that would be, we are the largest identifiable body of college-educated women in the world. Why wouldn't we be helping remove barriers to education? And they're like, oh, yeah, that makes complete sense. So there's so many byproducts happening from that to meeting a young woman at Indiana State University who receives an award on her campus, and I'm gonna mangle the award, but it was a student providing education about their global community in a significant way. And she had received this award because of her work with the Circle of Sisterhood. And then to hear her story and her acceptance speech, I'd met Bo, and I didn't know this story. And in her acceptance speech, she said, most people don't know this about me, but I was born in China, and I was abandoned on the road because I was a girl.
Wow.
As a baby, as an infant. And so I was adopted by my American family, and I'm here today because of that.
Yeah.
But that's why it's so important for me to be involved in this work. I mean, it's just stories like that that just blow your mind. And so there's not only are what we're able to do internationally and domestically for girls, but the byproduct of what these undergraduate women are gaining. Because not until I read that book, Capitalist Guy, did I really, truly begin to understand my privilege.
Right.
I mean, I knew I was privileged, but I didn't really, truly get it. And so to see these young women at 18, 19, 20, 21 years old get it at that level is so cool to see, and be so passionate about it. I can't tell you how many of them come up to me and say, can I work for you? Most people don't know we have 2 part-time staff people. We don't have a big staff, and we don't have an office. So it's,
Right. Well, and...
anyway.
You know, and it just... Again, I think it speaks and wraps up kind of all the different things that we've talked about, right? From building relationships with, you know, well, first your core group of 10 women who you sat down and said, well, what are the possibilities for this?
Mm-hmm.
To all the different relationships you've built across the U.S. in Circle of Sisterhood, and then the relationships that happen on campuses with, you know, women inviting other women to join in this movement, and then inviting men and other members of the fraternal community to come in to do this, and it all comes from this place of, you know, here's this possibility that we could achieve, rather than,
right,
oh, let's just complain about this problem. No, let's look and see, here's what this possibility is. And so, you know, I think...
Well, and I,
go ahead.
Yeah, I truly believe that the only change significant that has changed that has happened for our community is because of those kinds of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Is a group of people just sitting down around a table saying, but what if? I mean, what if? What are the possibilities? That's how change occurs, is living in that space and being willing to have a conversation in that space.
Yeah.
And we got to do more of that. And I think conferences like AFA and even these student regional conferences are the places for those conversations to occur.
Right. And just, yeah. So my last question, and I know, you know, we'll link to Circle of Sisterhood in the show notes, but how do people get involved in this? I think read Half the Sky, you know.
Oh, yes.
Like, please make it one of your books to read, and then read the follow-up book too, but Half the Sky for sure. And but how else can people who are curious get involved and help to further this work of removing those barriers for women?
Well, you know, the first thing I'm going to say is they could donate.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, because, you know, the bottom line. And this is, so I think part of the reason this has picked up so much steam is because so little goes so far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the developing world, $53 sends a girl to school for an entire school year with everything she needs. New
right.
school uniforms, school supplies, school lunch every day. So everything she needs. And that's, you know, when I ask most sorority women what they spend $53 on, they'll say...
One pair of shoes.
A pair of shoes. No, they don't even get both shoes. They only get one shoe, right? So I think that's why... And you can significantly see how the impact what their money's doing. But I think people, you know, this is only moved the way it has because people talk about it, and because people appreciate what our community can do to have a significant impact on what is labeled a global crisis. And so, talking about it, in our very first year, we tried to get just connectors involved, people who would talk to other people, their circle of influence, and get them talking about it. I think that's a way for people to be involved. We have a volunteer corps, so we have 100 volunteers doing different things. If somebody actually wants to get involved that way, that's another way. Campus professionals, I mean, if they're, the likelihood with 200 campuses, there's a lot of them out there on the campuses. So encouraging your women to maintain their involvement, because to us, it's as important to fundraise as it is to create awareness.
Right.
So if they're out there having conversations in their community about the global issues affecting women, that's significant. Like our last data, we collect data at the end of every academic year about what our campus partners are doing. And over 65,000 people were educated in the last academic year alone, and that's a 40% response rate on our survey, about the global issues affecting women because of what these sorority communities are doing. 65,000 people.
Wow.
So if our sorority communities are educating more people about this the global issues affecting women, more people are becoming aware. And we're the most privileged people in the world. And so we're all starting to understand our privilege differently, which is significant.
Yeah.
Especially at that age. We can have a whole different conversation about this generation and what they're going to do for the world. But there's volunteer opportunities. There's donor opportunities. There's opportunities to support communities around the country that are helping us. There's opportunities. We're trying to get more alum groups involved, so alumni panelics and alumni chapters. So getting involved that way. I mean, there's so many ways that people can touch the organization. It really just depends on what they want to do.
Yeah.
And how much time they want to give.
Very true. But I think I love your idea of helping people to understand their privilege as they move forward in supporting this work. And I think, you know, the more we do that, the more we're willing to support Circle of Sisterhood or anything that's going to remove barriers and decrease oppression and make our world a more caring and considerate place for all of us to live in a connected place. And so I am so sorry, go ahead.
I have to tell you, as one of those brothers for sisters, that, you know, I could say it warms my heart, but it's deeper than that. So when the men understand, because I've had a lot of men ask me this question. So what would this issue be for men? Like, how could we rally the men around an issue like this in the community? And, of course, my response to that is, can't you just support the women?
Right.
I mean, can't you just support what we're doing? And then, you know, that makes them think differently. But so we have a lot of men that support us, you being one of those, Matt, and so that appreciate it and understand it and know it. And because if the men aren't uplifting the women, it's never going to happen completely.
Right.
And so to know that there are men out there that understand it's important. People can label it a feminist issue all they want. It's not. It's a human rights issue.
Right.
And so I can't even describe to you how it feels to me when the men feel it's as important as the women feel it is, because they understand. And so as that piece of what we do continues to grow, I just think it's going to be so incredible on college campuses when the men and women can sit in the room together and say, because of what we're doing, communities are changing. Women have more opportunity. Their children have more opportunity, because women are going to reinvest 90% into their children. So, I mean, I think those are such significant and powerful conversations that it could occur. It's just a challenge for these women to get the 18, 19, 20-year-old men to know it's their issue too.
Right.
Right.
But I think, you know, my brain went to this, to, you know, that conversation with the guy saying, well, what about getting the men access to education? And then we say, well, they already do. Right.
Yeah.
And just like, I can already see their face going, oh, wait a second. She's right.
Yeah. Like, well, yeah, and the schools we built, boys are there too. I mean,
right.
Funny school builds for boys and girls. So, but the covenant is girls are there in equal numbers. So you're educating your girls too. I mean, that's the deal.
Right.
And some of these communities are great at that. But these, you know, in these communities, the boys are already in the school. They're already educated. I mean, I lived in a village in Africa for a week with where we're funding. It was a significant culture shift for this community to say, yes, we will put our girls in school. And, you know, I lived with a family where the boys didn't talk to me and young men because I was a female. And at one point, I was trying to show my host mother that I had run into a scorpion that day. So I was, because we didn't have the same language, so I was drawing it on the ground so she could see it. And one of the boys looked over and went, "Scorpion." So not only do they speak English because they're taught it in like what equate to our seventh grade, so they're taught English. So they could have talked to us the whole week,
right?
And they just didn't. It's their culture.
Interesting.
And so so learning those things and knowing those things and understanding those things helps us all realize we could do more. I mean, just so imagine where that the chief of that village, he wanted a medical clinic. Well, okay, if all the people in your village are educated, you're more likely to get there to that space, right? And have
right.
the people to work in that clinic. Anyway, it's just fast. I've learned so much, and I have learned, I can't even, more in 6 years than I've learned in my entire life.
Yeah.
Without actually being on a college campus or in a classroom.
Well, and I want to thank you so much for, first, just all of the work that you are doing to inspire and empower sorority women and fraternity men, myself included, to make a difference and to care and to recognize our opportunities in the world. So thank you for continuing to do that and for seeing something that was accessible to us, but that needed somebody to say, hey, look, we can do this. And congratulations on six just really awesome, successful years. I'm one of those people that hopes to see it just continue to grow and do amazing things and just empower and impact fraternity and sorority communities to impact the world around us. So thank you for that. And also thank you just for sharing all of your different thoughts around building better leaders and building better members and impacting our communities in a positive way and just the potential and possibility we have in fraternity sorority life. Because, you know, I think a lot of times we get bogged down in all the problems, but we forget to look at the incredible opportunity that we have as educators. And so thanks for reminding us of that and giving some really solid ways that we can move forward with that with our men and women that we work with.
Absolutely. So. And thank you for asking. I mean, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So I just look forward to watching you continue to impact the world and to working alongside you in whatever way I can to move forward with that. So
right back at you, Matt.
Thanks so much, Jenny, and have a wonderful day.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye.
So that's our show for today. I strongly encourage you to check out the Circle of Sisterhood and all the good they're doing in the world online. And, as always, if you've got questions, comments, or thoughts for future podcasts, tweet at me, @MattDeeg, or leave a comment on iTunes or on the blog. Until next time, stay curious.